Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. Race can often play a part in how certain people view certain situations. In 2013, a black teenage girl went to the front door of a home in a predominantly white neighborhood near Detroit, Michigan. She had gotten into a car accident and was looking for some help. The actions of the homeowner that night would raise many questions about how people talk about race and violence within the United States. Renisha McBride was a 19-year-old recent graduate of Southfield High School and worked at Ford Motor Co. Her loved ones would describe Renisha as quiet and hardworking. She liked to keep herself to herself, and she had ambitions of one day becoming a nurse. On Friday, the 2nd of November 2013, Renisha set out from her home in her white Ford Taurus. Shortly thereafter, her mother received a phone call from police, who provided her with some very tragic and unexpected news. Renisha's body had been discovered near Warren and Outer Drive in Dearborn Heights. Renisha had been shot in the face with a shotgun. Speaking with Fox 2, Renisha's aunt, Bernita Spinks, said, "All our kids are getting killed. We're burying our kids. It's devastating." She revealed her theory that Renisha had been murdered in Detroit and then dumped in Dearborn Heights because of the close proximity to the city. She asked the public for their help in justice being served, stating, "If you're watching and you heard anything or saw anything, don't feel like you're a snitch. Come and tell what you saw. Give us some closure." The following day, there would be a massive break in the case when investigators announced that Renisha hadn't been killed elsewhere and dumped. She had actually been shot dead on the front porch of a house, and they believed that the occupant of said house had pulled the trigger. While investigators were remaining tight-lipped about the facts surrounding the shooting, Renisha's family would reveal that around 2:30 a.m., Renisha had crashed her car. Since the battery on her mobile phone had died, she knocked on the front door of a home of the 16800 block of Outer Drive for help. However, when the occupant of the home opened their front door, they shot Renisha with a shotgun. Bernita said that even if the occupant had felt threatened and feared that Renisha was breaking into her home, her death was not justified. She said, "He shot her in the head. For what? For knocking on his door. If he felt scared or threatened, he should have called 911. Bernita revealed that Renisha's family had already met with officials from the prosecutor's office and shared the belief that Renisha had been racially profiled. She stated, "There is no windows broken. My niece didn't bother anyone. She went looking for help and now she's dead." Renisha had been shot dead in a predominantly white suburb, and much like Florida, Michigan had the controversial Stand Your Ground law, which allows people to use deadly force if they feel as though their life is in imminent danger. It wasn't yet known if the shooter was planning on invoking the Stand Your Ground provision or not. You can read more about this law on the Votacast app. Investigators would ask the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office to issue a warrant for the resident of the home where Renisha was fatally shot. Later that day, however, the Prosecutor's Office would send back the request and demand that further investigation needed to be submitted to the office before a decision could be made. Meanwhile, a group of around 40 friends and family members held a vigil for Renisha outside the home where she had been murdered. At the time, nobody was inside the home. They gathered, prayed, and chanted, "No justice, no peace." Community activist Ron Scott said that they were looking for justice to be served and urged prosecutor Kim Worthy to press charges against the home owner. While the shooter had still not been identified, Lieutenant James Serwatowski would tell the Detroit Free Press that he had told investigators that he believed that Renisha was breaking into his home and that his firearm had discharged accidentally. The shooter in question had already retained a defense attorney, Gerald Carpenter, and while information about the shooting was still scarce, she would state in the media that the shooting was justified. She said, "I'm confident that when the evidence comes, it will show that my client was justified and acted as a reasonable person who's in fear for his life would." Renisha's family had also retained a lawyer, Gerald Thurswell, and he said that it was hard to believe that it was an accident when the gun was in Renisha's face when the trigger was pulled, as investigators on the case were gathering more information to provide to the prosecutor's office. Renisha was laid to rest. Her funeral was held at the House of Prayer and Praise in Wyoming, Detroit. Friends and family filed into the church to pay their final respects. Her aunt, Kay Lumpkin, said that the funeral theme was that Renisha's death was a tragedy that should not be swept under the rug. Due to the horrific head injuries that Renisha had sustained, her family were forced to have a closed casket. Crystal Bird, her cousin, said, "We couldn't get a chance to look at her face for the last time." You can read more about Renisha's funeral up on the Vodacast app. The shooting of Renisha was widely compared to the shooting of Trayvon Martin. However, the case really didn't gain as much traction in the public imagination. Far too often, when it comes to reporting in general, black women can be stereotyped as angry or unyielding, and a number of early reports on the murder had a racial bias. Renisha was described as being murdered and dumped somewhere near Detroit, which gave the case kind of a seedy undertone, as if Renisha had done something to deserve what had happened to her. When it comes to black women who are victims of crime, there are very few cases that pierce the mainstream media bubble, and this case was no different, especially at the very beginning. Just the day after Renisha was laid to rest, prosecutors announced that they were launching a review to determine whether the shooter should be arrested and charged. Meanwhile, Renisha's autopsy report was released. Assistant medical examiner Kilak Keisha ruled her death a homicide, and the report read in part, "There is an entrance gunshot wound to the face, with no evidence of close-range discharge of a firearm noted in the skin surrounding the wound." Attorney Thurswell, who had been hired by Renisha's family, would reveal more information about the events leading up to the shooting. He said that a woman and her family had assisted Renisha after she crashed her car. She was bleeding from the face, and the woman said that she kept saying she just wanted to go home. It was evident to the woman and her family that Renisha was confused and disoriented after the crash. She had attempted to get back in her car, but it was undrivable. The woman said that as Renisha wandered off, she called 911. This was at around 12:57 a.m. It still wasn't known what happened to Renisha during the space between that 911 call and when she was shot dead. Speaking about the defense of the shooter, Attorney Thurswell said he didn't understand how the homeowner could have felt in imminent danger if he was inside a locked house. He said, "I don't see how he can avail himself on the stand your ground defense." Arnold Reed, a Farmington Hills attorney, echoed this sentiment. He described it as unjustified to open your front door and shoot somebody in the face simply because they rang your doorbell. "Don't open the door and call police," he stated. The 911 call from the shooter would be released in the media. It would be revealed that the phone call had been placed at 4:45 a.m. He reported shooting a stranger on his porch and then hung up.
Human rights emergency.
Yes, I just shot somebody on my front porch with a shotgun banging on my door.
Around a minute after the phone call was placed, the dispatcher said, "Just received a 911 call from a male who thinks he just shot someone on his porch. Then he hung up. We're trying to call back." A responding officer then told the dispatcher, "There's somebody down on the porch. It appears it's going to be a black female." Detroit Police Department would also release a timeline of the car accident that Renisha had been involved in. It had occurred in a Detroit neighborhood around a mile northwest of the Dearborn Heights home where she was shot and killed. The accident had taken place shortly before 1 a.m. Renisha had driven into a parked car. She appeared to be dazed and confused as she left the scene. Police arrived at 1:30 a.m. and by 2:50 a.m. they were still at the scene writing a report on the crash and making arrangements for the car to be towed. What happened between the crash and Renisha being shot on the porch still remained unclear. However, attorney Thurswell stated that they believed that Renisha may have had a concussion. The toxicology report would be completed a couple of days later. It would be publicly released and showed that at the time of Renisha's murder, she had alcohol and marijuana in her system. Attorney Thurswell stated that the findings had no bearing on the case, as far as he was concerned. It didn't diminish the tragedy, and as attorney Thurswell said, in fact, it makes her less of a threat to him. He was safely locked inside his house. All he had to do was call 911. They would have responded in 2 minutes before he blew her head off. Drunk driving is, of course, a crime, but it isn't a crime that warrants a death sentence. Just the following day, it would be announced that 54-year-old Theodore Wafer had been arrested and charged with the murder of Renisha. Prosecutor Worthy said that she had not been influenced by the protests. She revealed that Theodore had shot through a locked screen door after opening the front door, and revealed that they did not believe that he had acted in lawful self-defense. Michigan law declares that there is no duty to retreat if you're in your own home, but lawful self-defense requires an honest and reasonable belief of imminent death or imminent great bodily harm. Renisha was unarmed and there was no evidence that she was attempting to break in to Theodore's home. He was charged with second-degree murder, manslaughter, and use of a gun during a felony. You can see a photograph of Theodore on the Vodacast app. After the charges were filed, Renisha's parents, Walter Ray Simmons and Monica McBride, thanked the prosecutor's office. They didn't want to speak publicly until charges had been filed, because as they said, they didn't want to harm the investigation.
We just want to thank the prosecuting office for the thorough job that they've done to bring the charges that they brought against Mr. Wafer. I don't even know why I'm saying Mr. Wafer. This monster that killed my daughter.
You took a life, and you took a beautiful life that was starting to blossom into a beautiful woman. And for that, I hope you stay in jail for the rest of your life.
Walter said that happy memories will hopefully make the hard times for the family a little easier, such as family trips to Disneyland. He said that Renisha's kindness and her smile could brighten up anyone's day. Monica said, she was never brought up to be a harmful person to anybody. She always wanted to help you. If she couldn't help you, she would go and get some help, find somebody that could help you. Walter stated that he could not imagine in his wildest dreams that somebody would fear Renisha so much that they pick up a shotgun and shoot her in the face while she was trying to find somebody to help her. He said, I can't grasp myself to that belief. To where? Why wouldn't you pick up the phone first? If I'm in danger, I'm going to call the police. They spoke about how this could have been anybody's daughter, but this time, it was theirs. Prayer had been helping them get through the unimaginable time, but there was still a long, painful road ahead of them. Showing true grace and compassion, they said they would agree with bond for the murder suspect, stating that justice would come not with jail time, but instead with a conviction. Theodore would be arraigned before Judge Mark Plawecki, who set his bond at $250,000 cash. During the court hearing, it would be revealed that when police arrived at the scene of the shooting, they found Renisha dead on the front porch. She was unarmed. Theodore then walked out of the side door of the house with his hands out to his sides. He allowed the officers to search his home when they found a Mossberg 12-gauge pump action shotgun with a pistol grip inside near the front door. A spent shell casing was found nearby. He had shot Renisha through the closed and locked screen door. In early December, a preliminary hearing was held. Carmen Beasley would be testifying during the hearing. She said that around 1 a.m. she had heard a loud bang outside her Detroit home. She went outside to discover that a car had crashed into her parked car. She called 911 and went over to Renisha to offer assistance. She said that Renisha was bleeding from the head and was pressing her hands to her head. She said she couldn't find her phone She was patting her pockets. She just kept saying she wanted to go home. Carmen said that she went back into her home to call Renisha an ambulance. But when she went back outside, Renisha was gone. She described Renisha as being discombobulated and appeared to be in a very confused state of not knowing where she was. There was no testimony about where Renisha was for the next few hours. Over those few hours, rain had fallen and temperature dipped into the 40s. Renisha somehow ended up 4 blocks away, outside Theodore's home in Dearborn Heights. At around 4:30 a.m., he called police to report that he had shot somebody on his porch, who had been knocking on his door. A photograph of Renisha's leg, feet displayed, and it showed that her left foot had broken through the sole of her boot. Dr. Kilak Keisha, who performed the autopsy, said that Renisha had a blood alcohol level of about 0.22, which is more than twice the legal limit for driving. Under cross-examination by defence Carpenter, he was asked if somebody could become more aggressive after a head injury, to which he replied, "That's possible," before adding that Renisha also could have been quiet and withdrawn while drunk. Sergeant Sean Kolonik would also testify that he examined the shotgun that had been used to shoot Renisha. He found it to be in working order and testified that it did not malfunction. He said, without pulling the trigger, this gun would not go off. A number of loved ones of Renisha were in court for the preliminary hearing. They wore t-shirts with her face emblazoned on the front, with the words, "Don't shoot, call 911. Judge David Turf would ultimately determine that there was enough evidence against Theodore for him to stand trial. He rejected the self-defense argument and said that there were other ways he could have protected himself, such as calling 911. He said, "This court recognizes you can't automatically penalize somebody for making a bad decision when pressed to react quickly. But at the same time, we can't allow one to use a bad decision as a shield to criminal prosecution." Theodore would be ordered to stand trial in June of 2014, and he entered a not guilty plea. A couple of months before it was scheduled to begin, Theodore's defense attorneys would request a new judge, and request that the trial be moved out of Wayne County because of intense publicity. Judge Kiana Lillard would refuse to remove herself, but the motion would be referred to Circuit Court's chief criminal judge, who would state he would make a decision later in the month. The defense were wanting Judge Lillard removed because she had worked on the prosecutor's office until last August. Ultimately, Judge Lillard would be removed from the case, and it was handed instead to Judge Dana Hathaway. The trial would then be pushed back until July. With such a high-profile and emotionally charged case, prosecutors were asking for as many as 200 people for the jury pool. Both the prosecution and the defense were wanting to ensure the prospective jurors had not made up their mind about the case based on what they had watched or read in the media. The entire trial would be focusing on whether Theodore felt as though he was being threatened and whether his actions were reasonable under the circumstances. It was going to be an uphill battle for Theodore's defense team because he had shot through a locked screen door. The stand your ground defense is certainly more plausible if somebody is breaking into somebody's home or has entered somebody's home. The threshold for a stand your ground defense is extremely high. The murder trial began on the 23rd of July. During opening statements, defense Carpenter portrayed Theodore as a man under siege in his own home. She said that he was awoken by a series of boom, boom, boom pounding sounds on his front door. She said that this caused him to grab a shotgun, open the front door, and fire.
So he goes back to the kitchen and guess what happens again? Bow, 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 bow on the front door! Oh, and it is this time? This time he knows. Or he doesn't know, but what he's going through his heart and in his head is, it's me. They're coming to get me. Get your mindset in Ted's mind. Ted's mind. What was he going through at that moment he shot?
She asked the jury to put themselves in Theodore's shoes. She stated, "His heart is coming out of his chest. There's a shadowy figure coming off the porch, and it's going to the side of the house. He thinks it's not one person, it's two or more people." She claimed that Theodore heard metal breaking on his front door, and feared that a number of people were breaking into his home. Prosecutor Danielle Hageman-Clark showed the jury a photograph of a smiling Renisha, followed by a photograph of her dead on the blood-stained porch. She said that Theodore had other options that night. There was no sign of an attempt to break in and no damage to the front door or the screen door. She stated, "His actions that night, unnecessary, unjustified, and unreasonable." She said that during the trial, she did not need to prove that Theodore intended on killing Renisha that night.
"I don't have to prove that he intended to kill anyone. And it's not the people's position that he did intend to kill Renisha McBride. It's the people's position that he knowingly created a situation where death or great bodily harm was likely to occur."
Renisha's best friend, Amber Jenkins, would be one of the first witnesses to testify. She told the jury that on the night that Renisha was killed, they had been playing a drinking game with vodka and had been smoking marijuana.
"She wanted to play and I didn't. It wasn't nothing really else to do at her house besides watch TV, so."
Another friend, Devonta Bynes, testified that he had been expecting Renisha to come to his home for a small get-together. They were friends and co-workers. They had been texting throughout the night, but as hours passed, he realized that Renisha wasn't going to show up. He said that when he called her at one point, she was slurring her words and appeared to be drunk. He said he feared that somebody could have slipped her something. Carmen Beasley, who testified during the preliminary hearing, also testified once again. She spoke about the car crash, which had taken place outside her home.
"I told her that she was injured and that we needed to call the EMS. She seemed like she was scared. She just wanted to go home."
She said Renisha appeared to be intoxicated, but also appeared to be disoriented and confused by what was happening. Corporal Tim Ziwaki would acknowledge that a portion of the front screen door was leaning out of its frame. According to Defence Carpenter, this was evidence that Renisha had damaged the door. But according to the prosecution, the damage had come from the shotgun being fired through the closed door. He revealed that it had taken 10 days for police to dust the crime scene for fingerprints. Defence Carpenter seized the opportunity to criticise the handling of the evidence in the case. Mark Parinello, the evidence technician, was the one to dust for fingerprints, and under cross-examination he admitted he wasn't instructed by command officers to dust the scene immediately. Defence Carpenter revealed that Renisha's clothing had become contaminated, and it was discovered that maggots were found on her clothing while they were being stored at the Dearborn Heights Police Department. Mark, the evidence technician, shot back and claimed the contamination had taken place at the Wayne County Medical Examiner's office, where he alleged deer meat was being stored near Renisha's clothing. Mary Mazur, who is a spokeswoman for the Wayne County Medical Examiner's office, stated, "We do not store deer meat at the medical examiner's office," and suggested that the contamination was the result of a natural occurrence with flies, and it could have started back at the crime scene. Defence Carpenter would ask Mark why he didn't discover blood at Renisha's car while he was looking for her cell phone on the 4th of November. He replied that he didn't discover the bloodstains at her car until a day later at a Detroit tow yard. She questioned once again whether evidence in the case had been mishandled. A recording between investigators and Theodore would be played out for the jury to hear. Theodore had immediately suggested to investigators that he didn't know his shotgun was loaded and that the shooting was an accident. The comments had come when investigators responded to a 911 call after the shooting. Sergeant Rory McManaman asked Theodore, "What happened here?" And he replied, "A consistent knocking on the door, and I'm trying to look through the windows and the door. It's banging somewhere else, so I open up the door, kind of like, 'Who is this?' and the gun discharged. I didn't know there was a round in it." He said to the responding officers that he hadn't recognized Renisha, and that the weapon discharged accidentally. This was a stark contrast to the self-defense claim that his defense team had put forward during their opening statements. Today's sponsor is Hidden Compass. It's an amazing, award-winning, woman-led media company that is turning storytellers and explorers into heroes and championing a new age of discovery. Hidden Compass have a digital magazine, podcast, and even a speaker series. And in November of this year, they're launching a modern exploration society, one that is global and inclusive. Just think of the National Geographic Society of 1888, but reimagined for 2021 and beyond. The stories on Hidden Compass nourish and challenge, and their aim is to inspire courage and curiosity. Just click the link in my show notes or head on over to hiddencompass.net for more. Sam Bruce, a special agent with the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives, testified that all calls to Renisha's phone went straight to voicemail after 12:59 a.m. Her damaged mobile phone was found inside the car that she had been driving. Detective Sergeant Kevin Lucidi said that the car's airbags had deployed and that it was possible that Renisha struck the windshield with her head, adding to the prosecution's theory that she was confused and disoriented when she left the crash scene and made her way to Theodore's front door. Testimony would then be heard from Detective Sergeant Sean Kolonik, a forensic firearms expert, who told the jury that the shotgun used to kill Renisha had not been fired by accident. When he examined the shotgun, he found it to be functioning properly, adding that the gun has a lot of force and won't go off unless the trigger is pulled. He stated, "If I have my finger on this trigger, I better be ready to shoot something." He said that Renisha had been shot at a distance of 8 feet or less. Detective Sergeant Stephen Gurka would also inform the jury that Renisha had been unarmed, and he found no evidence of forced entry or attempted forced entry. Under cross-examination, he said that they hadn't felt the need to seek fingerprint evidence because Theodore told them that the gun had discharged accidentally. He did not view the case as an attempted home invasion. The final testimony to be presented by the prosecution was testimony from Dr. Kilak Kesha, who had performed the autopsy. She described how Renisha had been shot in the face from less than 3 feet away. Graphic photographs of Renisha's body were shown to the jury, while Dr. Kesha described how her brain had been pulpified by the shotgun blast which killed her. After the officer's testimony, the prosecution rested their case. It was now time for the defense to present theirs. Their first witness would be Dr. Werner Spitz, a former medical examiner, who is being paid by the defense. He said that photographs of Renisha's hand showed a small, superficial laceration, which could have come from pounding on something. This accusation led to a sparring match with the prosecution. Under cross-examination, prosecutor Athena Seringas noted that Renisha had been in a car accident and could have very well harmed her hand in the crash. She pressed Dr. Spitz to give a scientific reason for his opinion, and he replied, "There's no way of associating these findings with anything but the event that led to the death." Dr. Kesha, who had performed the autopsy, had based her findings on that, as opposed to photographs, and she said that there was nothing remarkable about the condition of Renisha's hands. The defense would also contest how far Renisha had been from the front door when she was shot dead. Michael Blash, a former state police detective lieutenant, would say that he believed that Renisha had been shot from just a few inches away. One of the most highly anticipated moments of the trial came when Theodore was called to testify on his own behalf. Up until now, he had remained silent about his actions that night, and while his defense team were claiming self-defense, in the audio from the shooting that night, Theodore had claimed that the shooting was an accident. It was pretty much a given that he was going to testify, because his defense team would want him to convey the fear he had felt that night. He detailed how he had awoken that night to somebody banging on his front door, and he said he wasn't going to be a victim in his own home. He claimed that he followed the loud bangs from his front door to his side door, and then back to the front again before he picked up his shotgun. He said to the jury that the noises had made him mad, and he didn't want to be a victim.
"And when you shot that shotgun, Ted, were you afraid for your life?"
"Yes."
"And did you think that danger was just about to get you?"
"Yes." "Can't explain that. Your Honor, I went to sleep that evening. I didn't expect I'd have to fight for my life and end up shooting and killing someone. It's the first thing that came out.
Today, in front of this jury, why did you pull the trigger?
To protect, to save myself, to defend myself. It was them or me at that moment.
He said that he opened the front door slightly and saw that the outer screen door was damaged. He stated that as he opened the front door further, this person came out from the side of my house, so I raised the gun and shot. He said he thought that there may have been more than one person and stated, I pulled the trigger to defend myself. It was them or me. His testimony during the trial contrasted what he had originally told investigators, that he didn't realize the gun was loaded and it discharged accidentally. Theodore told the jury that he couldn't afford a security system, so he had purchased a shotgun for defense around 6 years prior. He had purchased his home back in 1994 and said that the neighborhood had changed drastically since then. Over time, crime had worsened in the neighborhood, he said, and he found liquor bottles and drug paraphernalia around the street. During his testimony, Theodore appeared both remorseful and defensive. He was emotional on the witness stand as defense Carpenter asked him if he often thought about the shooting, to which he replied that he did.
This poor girl, she had her whole life in front of her. I took that from her.
He said that the incident happened too fast. Some in attendance felt as though his display of emotion was put on. Under cross-examination, prosecutor Syringus asked Theodore, do you remember crying for 2 to 3 hours after you shot and killed Renisha McBride? Before showing the jury a 42-minute video of Theodore being questioned by investigators. He appeared calm as he drank a cup of coffee and said it sounded like somebody was trying to get into his house. He stated, it did not seem like somebody asking for help. He said he did not know Renisha or know why a woman was trying to get into his home. He added that he thought Renisha could have been a neighbor's kid and said the shooting was in self-defense as far as he was concerned. However, he added, I should have called you guys first. His demeanor in the video really contrasted his demeanor on the witness stand. In the video, he was calm and collected, and on the witness stand, he appeared to be an emotional wreck. Prosecutor Syringas would pick apart the inconsistencies in statements Theodore had made to investigators and made on the witness stand. He had stated to her, I wasn't looking for a confrontation. I was hoping to end a confrontation, to which she responded, you sure ended it, Mr. Wafer. Before asking if his strategy was to shoot first, ask questions later. She asked him about his initial statements to investigators that he didn't realize the shotgun was loaded, to which he replied, I forgot about it. He said he probably took the safety off the gun with his thumb when he pulled the weapon from the box. He also claimed he didn't initially aim at Renisha's face. Prosecutor Syringas showed the murder weapon to the jury before returning to Theodore and stating, why not say, back up, what are you doing here? Your reaction to seeing a young African-American female on your porch was to shoot her.
So the first chance you had to talk to any law enforcement or to talk to 911, you said, I just shot somebody banging on my door, right?
That's what it says, yes.
Didn't say anything about a break-in, right?
No, I didn't.
Didn't say anything about you were afraid, right?
No.
Shoot first, ask questions later, right?
It was a threat, the threat that was coming in my house, yes.
We did see Wafer become emotional when talking about seeing McBride's body on the porch just after he shot her.
I don't think we'd ever be here if the EMS showed up for her in the first place.
So this is all somebody else's fault, right?
It's not somebody else's fault.
You're the one who shot her, right?
Yes.
The prosecutor also pointed out that Theodore did not tell the 911 operator that he believed that somebody was breaking into his home, or that he was in fear. She asked if Theodore was a paranoid person and whether the shooting had been prompted by anger, because he believed he was being harassed by neighborhood children who had pinballed his car in the past. She stated, "You were mad and wanted to handle this yourself. You never said anything about being scared. You were looking for a confrontation. You wanted to show that you were armed. You opened the door to go outside." Theodore would be the final witness to testify during the controversial trial. During closing arguments, prosecutors repeatedly emphasized that Theodore had other options, easier options, than to shoot Renisha in the face with a shotgun. Prosecutor Patrick Muscat stated, "She was a young girl looking for help. What he did had to be immediately necessary, and it wasn't. It was reckless. It was negligent. I don't know how to describe it. It was horrific. How about shutting the door? How about calling 911? No, what he does is he engages. He creates the confrontation." Defense Carpenter, on the other hand, implored the jury to put themselves in Theodore's shoes. She said, "He armed himself. He was getting attacked." On rebuttal, Prosecutor Syringa stated that a murder conviction fit the case and said that Theodore decided to be judge, jury, and executioner. Following the closing arguments, the jury were sent off to deliberate. The crux of the case would be whether the jury believed that Theodore had acted under an honest and reasonable belief of death or grave bodily harm. After less than 2 hours of deliberation, they would return with a verdict.
Count one, murder in the second degree. Guilty of murder in the second degree.
They found Theodore Wafer guilty of second degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and felony weapons charges. As the verdict was read aloud, several members of Renisha's family gasped and then began to cry. Theodore just stared straight ahead of him. Outside of court, Renisha's mother, Monica, said that she was astonished by the verdict but relieved. She said that she was upset by the defense's attempts to slander Renisha's name.
She was a regular teenager, and she was well raised and brought up with loving family, and her life mattered.
Her father, Walter, said that people have the right to bear arms, but only with reason and responsibility. Speaking of Theodore, he said, "We learned he was a cold-blooded killer."
People have a right to bear their arms and everything else, but you have to do it with reason and responsibility, you know? Not just murder somebody, when it's not justified.
Theodore's defense would request that he be freed on bond until the sentencing phase.
It would be more of a risk to his safety and everybody's safety if you do remand him right now to the Wayne County Jail. I don't think that's a safe place.
Your Honor, he's been convicted of second-degree murder. I think the jury has spoken.
This was a very, very unique case, very unusual situation. He didn't go out of his house looking for this. It's not somebody who's going to go on a rampage if you let him out here. This is a quiet, introverted man, Your Honor, who has now been convicted of murder, too. But that doesn't change who he is, and he won't change, Your Honor, in these 2 weeks.
The request would be turned down. Before the sentencing phase, it was announced that Renisha's parents had filed a $10 million lawsuit against Theodore for wrongful death and negligence. Prosecutors announced that they would be seeking at least 17 years in prison for Theodore. The sentencing guidelines call for a minimum punishment, anywhere between 15 and 25 years in prison, and that would be in addition to an automatic 2-year sentence for the unlawful use of a firearm. Defense Carpenter, however, was urging the judge to go way below the guidelines and instead sentence Theodore to as little as 2 years in prison, including the 2-year sentence on the gun charge. During the sentencing phase, the loved ones of Renisha were allowed to provide victim impact statements. Her sister Jasmine was the first to speak.
Renisha was a beautiful young lady with her whole life ahead of her. She was a goofy person with a smile that would light up any room. Renisha was smart kind and loving, and a family-orientated person. For me, she was more than just a sister. She was my best friend. We had our ups and downs, as many sisters would. More good times than bad. Renisha was the youngest sister, but she often played the role as the big sister. When I needed someone to talk to, she was always there to listen. When I cried, she was always there to comfort me. When I ran across hard times, she was always there to lift my spirits. Losing my sister was one of the most devastating times in my life. Many days I sit and think about the good times we shared and how they were cut short by a person's cowardly actions. Throughout the trial, Mr. Wafer stated how this tragedy has affected his life and how he often cried. Mr. Wafer also stated that killing my sister was an accident. I was taught to apologize when I made a mistake or an accident. Never once have I heard Mr. Wafer send his condolences or apologize to my family for taking our loved ones. I find it very hard to believe that his actions was an accident. I ask you today, Judge Hathaway, when sentencing Mr. Wafer, that you give him the maximum. I believe he needs time to think about his actions, like why he didn't call 911 instead of opening his door and killing my sister. Mr. Wafer, your actions impact a lot of other people besides just yourself. I thank God the judicial system worked and showed you as the killer you truly are. Somewhere down the line in life, I have to forgive you in order to be accepted into heaven myself. But I will never forget the pain, the hurt, the heartache, or the devastation you caused my family.
She said that losing her sister was the most devastating thing to happen in her life. And that when she thinks about all the good times she had with her, she then remembers that her life was cut short. Her father, Walter, would also provide an emotional victim impact statement.
This man has ruined our family life. It's not a day that go by that I don't think about my daughter. I never had the opportunity to see her grow up, be a woman, have kids. Judge, I just hope you really give him the maximum sentence that's possible.
He also read aloud a victim impact statement from her younger sister, Lindsay, who couldn't say the words herself.
My sister was innocent and did not deserve what you have done to her. Having an older sister is very important for a girl growing up, and you threw that all away without even thinking about how it would affect others or even her directly. I hope while you're sitting all alone in that cold, dark jail cell that you will reevaluate yourself and realize that the bad that you've done and how horrible you affected people in our family.
Theodore would be given the opportunity to speak. He apologized to Renisha's family before asking for mercy.
To the parents, family, and friends of Renisha McBride, I apologize from the bottom of my heart. And I am truly sorry for your loss. I can only hope and pray that somehow you can forgive me. My family and friends also grieve. For from my fear, I caused the loss of a life that was too young to leave this world. And for that, I will carry that guilt and sorrow forever. Yeah. I only wish that I could take this horrible tragedy back. I ask the court and your honor for mercy.
Judge Dana Hathaway would ultimately follow the recommendation of the prosecution and sentence Theodore Wafer to a minimum of 17 years in prison, with a maximum of 32 years in prison. In handing down the sentence, she stated, "I do believe that you acted out of some fear, but mainly anger and panic. An unjustified fear is never an excuse for taking someone's life. So what do we have? One life gone and one life ruined." Because of Theodore's age, he had essentially received a life sentence. Walter said he felt as though Theodore's remorse was not genuine, and that the sentence was justified. Her aunt, Bernita, said, "His tears were for the judge. It wasn't for us." In June of 2015, a settlement was reached in the wrongful death lawsuit Renisha's parents had filed against Theodore. Due to a confidentiality agreement, the financial details were not publicised. In 2017, Theodore would appeal his sentence and request a new trial. He urged that jurors should have been given instruction that he shot Renisha because her actions showed she was breaking into his home. The Supreme Court, however, turned down his request and said that they would not be reviewing the case. Judge Hathaway had explained the self-defense theory to jurors, but said that evidence didn't show that Renisha was trying to break into his home.
She loved their animals. She was an animal lover. She always had an animal, so preferably a dog. She loved their animals. And as her father said, she was very family-oriented. Family was always first. She would just be inclined to help wherever she could. And we instilled in her that if you can't help a person, don't hinder them. She never was brought up to be a harmful person to anybody. She always wanted to help you. If she couldn't help you, she would go and get you some help. Find somebody that could help you. Hey, mom, hey, dad, this person, this, can you tell me what to do to help them? I can't imagine in my wildest dreams of what that man feared from her to shoot her in her face. I can't grab myself to that belief. To where, why you wouldn't pick up the phone? If I'm in danger, I'm gonna call the police.
The dehumanization of people of color can sometimes tragically result in innocent people carrying the burden of suspicion, simply for no other reason than the color of their skin. Renisha McBride found herself in a predominantly white, middle-class neighborhood in the middle of the night. She was doing nothing more than seeking out help, but it was the presumption of danger which escalated an innocent situation and resulted in Renisha losing her life and Theodore losing his freedom. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Alicia and Jenny. Morbidology really wouldn't be what it is without the support on Patreon. It helps to defray the costs of filing freedom of information requests, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much, much more. In return for your support up on Patreon, you can get exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, merch, ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes of some episodes, and much, much more. I'd also like to say a huge thank you to those who have left lovely reviews up on Apple Podcasts recently. And I'd like to address one I received about the episode on Ali Lee Steinfeld. I got a 1-star review from somebody who said that it was only my opinion that Ali was misgendered and that it confused them when I called her Ali as opposed to her dead name. As mentioned in the episode, Ali had come out as transgender before she was killed. I've posted her coming out post on social media. The murder trial is online and you can hear her dead named and misgendered throughout the trial. This isn't my opinion. To dead name somebody and misgender somebody completely invalidates them as a person. It's insensitive and extremely disrespectful to not refer to somebody as their preferred pronouns. Sorry for the rant, the review just really upset me and shows that we still have a long way to go in the fight for transgender rights. Also, remember, it's CrimeCon in London next weekend. I'm going to be there all weekend and I hope to see some of you there. There's still tickets left and they've even added day tickets. So if you want to come and hang out, use the code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And please stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Tapes from the Dark Side. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Season 3 of Tapes from the Dark Side.
Gilchrist County 911, what's the address of the emergency?
Brings you a new tale of true crime.
Yes, ma'am. I just shot my daughter and shot all my grandkids. And I'll be sitting on my step. And when you get here, I'm going to shoot myself.
Tapes from the Dark Side is a serialized true crime podcast. Each season, we take one case and investigate in depth, using original source audio and legal documentation to break down exactly what occurred, the potential motive behind each crime, and the judicial implications for those involved. This is Season 3, The Spirit Family Massacre.
I think everyone has a bit of a fascination with the dark side.